listening to Football in Europe, the weekly podcast covering the game across the continent.
Hello and welcome to Football in Europe. I'm Rob Daly. With me, as always, is Chris Parrott. Chris, hello.
Hello. How are we?
I'm good. You literally just landed, 2 hours ago after a flight from Washington?
Well, 2.5 hours, because it took me 1 hour to walk to the Heathrow Connect platform, which is the worst sign. I think Heathrow Express must have a monopoly. Maybe.
How expensive is that Heathrow Express?
Exactly. So you can go half the price and it takes 15 minutes longer to go to Paddington. However, there are zero...
Imagine starting a podcast with this. Well, no, go on, do it.
We have.
Do it.
So there are zero signs for the Heathrow Connect. It's almost like they've signed some deal, Heathrow Express, with Heathrow, and therefore there are no signs. Now, I travel quite a lot. I go through Heathrow quite a lot. I'm not mean to sound like some worldly traveller, but if I had landed from somewhere and wasn't English, you wouldn't have the foggiest.
Gabon.
Addis Ababa. Yeah, it is ridiculous. So, Heathrow, if you're listening, sort out your signs.
I tell you what, I know, that Heathrow Express, I hate it so much.
It's £38 return.
And they play, it's 25 one way in peak hour for a 10 minute train. Yep. And they play adverts on the whole thing.
Yeah.
So you're just hearing to da 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 and you're just shut.
And also, I didn't get it.
Can't use this.
Yeah, we can. Also, just very quickly, they do that thing when they try and make it like it's a plane. Please familiarise with the emergency.
They do that.
It's a 10 minute
journey. It's a 10 minute train.
Anyway, Football in Europe.
Chris, what are we talking about this week?
Plenty.
We've got to save this rubbish.
There's a new man at Leverkusen. There's a lot of stories in Germany involving some huge names. Grosskreutz, Royce and Goethe for very different reasons. I went to MLS. I've got a Ruben, you haven't. And Luis Enrique is stepping down.
Okay, Luis Enrique is going to be the first issue. After we talk about your MLS experience, because the season got underway this weekend, and we're going to be speaking to Phil Blacker, Sky Sports commentator on the MLS and the Eredivisie, but we're going to talk about China with him because he commentated on the Tevez League debut at the weekend. So Phil Blacker to come. MLS, Chris, tell us about it.
Yeah, well, it was the coldest I have ever been at a football match. It was...
Oh, mate, you're forgetting some horrible away days there, aren't you?
No, I'm not. My hands are just about recovered. It was one of... It made me think, because we commentate, both of us, a lot on Russian football and don't necessarily do it from Russia. I don't think I'm giving away too many trade secrets there. But you watch games there and you think, how are they... You know, it's so cold. And it was about, with the wind chill, it was about minus 10 at kickoff.
That was the temperature it was when I went to that Freiburg game this season.
Oh, yes, of course, yeah.
And we were in a booth. Yeah, like, I couldn't have done it outside.
By the end, when I was walking back to the metro, my face sort of it was almost out-of-body experience is the wrong thing.
Now, here's a question for you. Did you have a beer in your hand, though? Ice-cold beer?
Yeah, but I also had gloves on. It's the only way to get through
Yeah, but you're pouring that beer into your mouth hole.
Yeah, but there was some...
That's like, cooling you down.
Well, it was worth it because they still had the whole like popcorn and you know baseball or NFL. They still had these poor beer sellers going around. It's like minus 10.
Oh, mate, when you love that here, yeah, the guys coming up to the seat.
Oh, it's gorgeous, yeah.
So, how was the game?
Game was
what was the game? I don't think you've done that.
DC United against Sporting Kansas.
Have you just come off a 9-hour flight?
No, it wasn't the best game. It was 0-0, one missed penalty. All the action took place within 20 seconds when Sporting Kansas cleared two efforts off the line. But it was very enjoyable. The atmosphere was brilliant, actually, considering the
Some of the footage on the weekend, those atmospheres look... I saw a bit of the Atlanta game last night. I mean, the atmosphere looks great.
Yeah, I mean, the standard of football, it was the first game of the season. It felt like that.
It was cold.
And it was... The standard of football was pretty poor. Certainly tactically it was. But it's one game. It was a really enjoyable... it's a lot cheaper than going to NFL or basketball or NHL. Washington have teams in every major sport. And it was fun. And the atmosphere was good. They clearly learnt from I think they're imported in from, you know, the Bundesliga, where you have guys at the front who are, you know, cheerleaders is the wrong word. They're ultras. But basically it was the whole stand and everyone was jumping. It's last season in this... really archaic now stadium, which was built in the 60s.
Yeah, you were sending me pictures last night. It doesn't look football.
But they're moving to their first purpose-built ground for the start of next season. And you can see that it's a game that, you know, there's a wide range of society was there as well. There was lots of women, there was lots of kids. And it was a very enjoyable evening, even if the football, which is definitely, I don't think the football is quite as important as the whole occasion. For example, there was some very enjoyable, I think in this country, it's a bit of a faux pas to call for a yellow card. The entire stand called for the yellow card at one stage.
Did they? They wanted the booking.
And then cheered more for the booking than for the penalty. But no, it was very good. Lloyd Sam played. For all
oh,
of
yeah,
you,
I was going to say, was there anyone we really
he
know?
Was absolutely awful.
Was he?
Yeah. But there's a guy called Sean Franklin, who was a classy centre-half. But yeah, the game wasn't great, but the occasion was fun.
Okay. And we're going to talk about more non-European football later in China. But Chris, we've got to talk about Luis Enrique.
We have.
The man in charge of one of the biggest clubs in the world has announced after a 6-1 win against Sporting Gijón that he's leaving in the summer. It's no surprise, the club said that he had hinted last summer that this was on the cards. Luis Suarez said the only thing that surprised them, perhaps, was the nature of the timing of it. He literally told them in the dressing room after that midweek 6-1 win.
Yeah, I mean, here's a guy who's been talking about coaches should only have 12-month rolling contracts. It would have been a surprise had he announced he was staying and signed a new deal, I think, more than he's left. But I wonder if he realises that Barca felt like they need a bit of galvanising. You know, they were very limp in that. OK, Paris Saint-Germain were excellent in that 4-0 win, but Barca were... That wasn't the Barcelona you've come to expect under any coach, frankly, let alone Luis Enrique, who not so long ago that he won the treble under him, and he was, you know, he will still go down as the guy that, you know, delivered the fifth European Cup in their history in Berlin. But I just think maybe he felt, because they are still fighting on three fronts. They're top of the league, albeit with a game in hand. Then in the Copa del Rey final against Alaves, which you'd expect them to win. And you'll speak with Phil about it later. They're just about in contention in the Champions League. They're not mathematically out. So I think maybe he feels this is the time now, make this announcement. Then everybody realises they're playing for their futures in a way. They want to impress whoever the next guy is coming in. And it just gives that freshness for Barcelona for the remaining, 4 months of the season?
Well, the last two results they've had, 6-1 against Sporting Gijón, 5-0 against Enrique's former employer, Celta Vigo.
Yeah, and they played three at the back, certainly on Saturday. I don't know if he'll do that against Paris Saint-Germain. They were swamped in midfield at the Parc des Princes.
That was someone who'd never seen football before would work out that midfield was the issue in that game. He's won 8 out of 10 possible trophies.
Yeah.
I mean, extraordinary. And they did get some stick, the players, recently. And then the fans were cheering Luis Enrique's name at the weekend. Andres Iniesta said he didn't want him to go. Now, the potential candidates, obviously in England, Koeman and Pochettino are the two names based from England. Koeman with obvious Barcelona links, Pochettino obviously not, Espanyol links. And then Ernesto Valverde of Bilbao's the favourite. Sampaoli is also in the running. I don't know if personality-wise Sampaoli is the right fit. Tactically, he would be.
I would, if I was them, I would go. I know that there's the point that Valverde has, with limited resources at Athletic, done very well. And there is the sense that if he was given Barcelona, then he would, you know, take them on.
Yeah, they've spoken to him twice about the job before, apparently, yeah.
Can we just, first of all, can we knock this Arsene Wenger going there on the head immediately?
Mate, it won't happen, but don't you like it a little bit?
No.
Don't you like the idea? Why not?
What's he want? It's absolutely ridiculous. They don't need Arsene Wenger.
But I'd like to, if it happened for a year, I'd be loving that.
Oh, it would be very funny to watch them finish behind.
Stuff.
No, they wouldn't. I don't think they would. I think he'd probably sign Cocker.
In my head, I just picture it, him in the dugout. There's no way this is happening, but him at the dugout.
I can picture a player revolt if he goes there, akin to what's happening with his best player at Arsenal at the moment.
Very true.
I'd like to see Sampaoli given it. I was reading up about his assistant, Juan Manuel Leo,
Okay.
So there's this sense that it has to be someone with Barcelona in their blood. They are a different club to... I don't quite get the more than a club
more
argument.
Than a club, yeah.
I don't think that's possible. But he... Well, Pep Guardiola credits him. I think he said he taught Guardiola how to learn the game, understand the game. He's credited with sort of inventing 4-2-3-1. He's Sampaoli's assistant. So that Barcelona ethos, I think Pep Guardiola also called him the maestro as well. So he would bring that Barcelona feel to it as Sampaoli's assistant. It would be...
I mean, there's been a tendency from that club to... Martino probably an anomaly, but certainly have people within the club to an extent. If we think Villanova, we think Enrique, who obviously went away and came back after Barcelona B, Pep.
So you'd kind of get that if you had Leo there as the assistant. I think it would be a bold call, but just the way that Sampaoli has... You sort of thought, after all he did with Chile and all of the clubs he was linked with, you thought, OK, when he finally comes to Europe, will he be a success? And, I mean, he's... OK, he hasn't yet had a full season at Sevilla, but they are well in the title race. I would be surprised if they don't go through to the quarterfinals of the Champions League. He's having a phenomenal...
But is he not too much of a... maverick in the way he talks and behaves? Barcelona famously interviewed Jose Mourinho for the job years ago and were turned off by his
Johan Cruyff
personality.
Was a bit of a maverick, wasn't he?
That's true, yeah.
But
Cruyff, there was history there.
Yeah, of course there was history, but I say maverick in the, you know, I think certainly in England we seem to consider mavericks as, you know, somehow we like to push them under the carpet, I think to our detriment. But I think it would be a bold, exciting approach to go for Sampaoli, as opposed to Valverde, who I'm sure will do a very good job. But I'd love nothing more than watching Jorge Sampaoli prowl up the touchline at New Camp.
Chris, you've sold me on it. I think it'll be Valverde.
I think you're probably right.
But I'd like that.
And then Sampaoli will go to Real Madrid, having been biffed off by Barcelona.
At the weekend, Barcelona did win 5-0 against Celta Vigo. Check out the Neymar chip goal from that game. Absolutely outstanding. Real Madrid without Bale, suspended after his red card. Morata and Ronaldo, I think, rested. They said injury, but he trained after the game. Rested. They won 4-1 at Eibar. Victory for Atletico as well. Sevilla haven't played yet at the time of recording. So that was the big story from Spain this week. Of course, Fernando Torres okay after his head injury as well. He was in the stands for Atletico's game against Valencia at the weekend.
Yeah, and without him, Griezmann too and Gamero. I just wonder if they were very impressive against Leverkusen, weren't they? Those two in particular, but Atleti. I just wonder whether they are hitting their straps at just the right time.
Yeah, but for what?
For the Champions League.
For the Champions League.
Exactly. They're out of the title race.
Yeah,
But I just wonder whether Atleti, and particularly those two, Griezmann had a...
Think how much European success Gamero's had.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like how you see is to the big pressure of European finals with Sevilla.
Yeah, and Griezmann had that spell around Christmas when he was slightly off.
No, absolutely right, but he's flying now.
But had an extremely busy summer and all of that, you'd expect that. Better to be off around Christmas than in March, April, May, when it really counts.
Okay, so that's Spain.
I haven't mentioned the own goal, sorry.
Oh yeah, please. So Hesse is on loan from Paris Saint-Germain at Las Palmas, and he scored his first goals there for the club.
He did.
They drew 3-3 with Real Madrid in their last game, of course, throwing away a 3-1 lead.
Yeah.
But that probably wasn't the main thing everyone was talking about, that game with Osasuna.
No, because it was 2-2, and one of the best own goals I've seen for quite a long time from Unai Garcia.
I don't think I've seen. Can you describe
it? So the ball comes across the face of goal. He's near the penalty spot. There's no one behind him. He doesn't necessarily know that, but he's under virtually no pressure. And he sort of inexplicably slips and slices the ball into the back of the net. He could have done so many things with it. He could have taken a touch. He probably could have passed.
Should we tweet this out?
But yeah, we'll tweet the
YouTube. FIE podcast.
It's really good. It's really good. And it was a fairly pivotal moment because it was 2-2. That happens. They go on and lose the game 5-2.
Okay, Chris, let's talk about Germany. There's a big managerial change there. Bayer Leverkusen have parted ways, really sacked their head coach, Roger Schmidt. Bayer Leverkusen losing 6-2 at Borussia Dortmund. And it was just the... It was the it seemed to be the breaking point for a team that, I mean, the Atletico game in the Champions League, why did he set them up as attacking as he normally does? It was inexplicable.
Well, yeah, do you get the sense that he was always one, for quite a while, maybe for a couple of months, one very bad result away from parting ways and conceding six?
Well, I thought that, and then they lost at home to Mainz 2-0, and you think, okay, that's, we're there, we're at the end of the road now. But the 6-2 loss and the nature of it and the late goals and the hammering was too much. And I think Rudy Völler, the sporting director of Leverkusen, said he was very upset to let Schmidt go. They have a great personal relationship, I think, which is good between a head coach and sporting director. But he's not versatile. He has that one system. They're great to watch because they'll either score four, concede two, or they'll concede six and score two like they did at Dortmund at the weekend. It was the nail in the coffin. It's been coming for some time. And I think Roger Schmidt's going to have to reflect on his coaching philosophy, because is he too attacking minded? Is he too set in his ways? Probably.
You need, at some stage, you need to show that you are developing, I think, as a team. And sometimes grinding out results is, you have to, if you know, if you want to win, don't you?
Yeah, absolutely.
And I just wonder as well whether that, I was reading a lot before the Atletico game as a key game for Schmidt to show that Leverkusen were moving forward. And can they compete in Europe against one of the big teams? And the answer was no.
No, you're absolutely right. And for me, they've been the disappointment. We talked about this before. You were saying, oh, it's disappointing there's no title race. And I was saying the biggest disappointment is them. Massively underachieving given the players they've got. They signed well, but not great in the summer. And they're the biggest failure in German football. And that's why Schmidt really had to lose his job. They didn't really have a choice. They have brought in a new man. And I'm off to see Bayer Leverkusen. I'm going to the game on Friday. They take on Werder Bremen at home in the Friday night fixture in the Bundesliga. Tayfun Korkut, who was in charge at Kaiserslautern, lost his job in Bundesliga 2 just in December, has taken over until the end of the season.
That's a stopgap, isn't it? If ever there was one.
They've written off the season. They're going out of the Champions League. They probably won't get in the European places. So you just get a... Apparently this guy was in the same sort of coaching era of players who came through that coaching academy with Roger Schmidt. But there's no way. They're an ambitious club. They want to be in the Champions League.
Yeah.
They'll be identifying the guy for next year. And I think that's probably a sensible thing. I don't begrudge them that.
There was a lot of talk on TV, and you could hear people in the stands, actually. Quickly back to MLS. Javier Hernandez, it would appear, well... I mean, that is something for Rudi Völler and Leverkusen now. Do you want to keep him? I'm sure the Bundesliga would like to keep one of their major superstars when it comes to rights and TV deals in the US for the Mexican audience in particular. Do you think he will stay, or do you think he'll go to America?
I think he'll stay. I think he will stay because Leverkusen took a punt on him. Granted, his track record at Real Madrid that loan season was not bad, and he was second choice to Benzema. And his goal-scoring record for United, but they still took a little bit of a punt on him. And I think he was very grateful for that. It's a low-pressure environment for him. I think if he doesn't score, he then feels the pressure quite badly, and he'll have these runs where 8 or 9 games as he had this season where he doesn't score. And I suppose it depends on the fee. If someone comes in and he's, I don't know how old he is. I want to say 29. I've probably overshot that a little bit.
No, but I think it is around that. You just wonder whether an LA Galaxy or someone... Who would almost certainly boost
his
wages.
Shout.
He would be in a... Well, Mexico is one of the most football-mad countries on earth. And I just wonder whether he would consider that as before he is in the twilight of his career.
Yeah.
I mean, it'd be sad to see him go from Europe, definitely.
No, I can picture that. I can picture that. In the Bundesliga at the weekend, along with Dortmund winning, Bayern won 3-0. At Cologne, and because Leipzig dropped points against Augsburg on Friday, Bayern have extended their lead at the top of the table. But Chris, there's lots of... Shall I just rattle through some of the interesting personal stories Bundesliga?
So three big names.
I've got four almost.
Okay, let's start with Kevin Grosskreutz.
So Kevin Grosskreutz, World Cup winner with Germany in 2014, has been sacked by Stuttgart, who are top of the second tier in Germany. They're going to be promoted. He was sacked after getting into a fight a few nights ago in Stuttgart City Centre, got his head kicked in, and there's photos of him with quite severe bruises. Now, there was no serious injury.
So I wasn't laughing at it. He was in hospital.
He's been in trouble before, things in kebab shops on nights out. He's he's had this kind of career. And 4 days later, Stuttgart said, we've got to terminate his contract. It was a big deal when he signed in January of last year, big name, part of the Champions League team with Dortmund in 2013 that got to the final. He said, he was very emotional in the press conference. He said, I don't want anything to do with football for the time being. I made a mistake. I'm very sorry. I accept the consequences and I hope to join the promotion party. Well, I'm sure he does.
That's the point, Kevin.
At the end of the season. It seems he's only 28.
Yeah.
I think he's wasting that career, isn't he?
He went to Galatasaray, didn't he?
Yeah, and he got in a bit of bother there
as
well.
And then I remember, I think I might have done his first game in Turkey when he came back a year ago. As you said, you consider himself older than that, but...
I know, I thought, I was at 28. So who knows what he's going to do. I'm sure he won't have a club until next season, based on the way he was talking.
Yeah.
Okay, next up, Marco Reus, big blow for Dortmund. He's out until early April after he picked up a hamstring injury in the game against Leverkusen. I think that's really going to derail Dortmund a bit because their run to form into the Champions League. This is him, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
You know, 15 games he's played this year, 6 goals, 7 assists. He's been brilliant.
There are certain players who you just think, oh, not again, because he's one of the very best. When he is fully fit. I mean, even when he came back after, 6 months out, first couple of games, he was phenomenal.
Well, yeah, that Legia game in the Champions League, you thought he had a hat-trick. Well, he had two in the end, as it turned out. But his teammate Mario Götze, by the way, who was re-signed from Bayern in the summer, might be out for the season, we don't know, but the club have said that he has an illness which relates to his metabolism is not working properly.
Yeah.
So he's been feeling very weak after some matches. He has been playing that well. He doesn't look 100% in shape. Apparently he's had problems maintaining his weight. So you've got two of the biggest names in German football there at Dortmund who are going to be out for a while. We don't know the extent to it, but it's sad for Götze because, you know, I was hoping he was going to play a lot more and he's not been important either. Yeah. And I'm sure it's been tied to this.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, good that they found it. And now they hopefully can get a prognosis and treat it somehow. But I mean, you go back to those two. I think we discussed it before, but I remember in 2012 on that run to the Champions League final when I think it's Franz Beckenbauer said, when it comes to a duo, he said there is no one better in world football than Reus and Götze.
Oh, did he?
And you felt when Reus came back and Götze had returned to Dortmund in November, December time, you thought, hang on, if these two guys click again, maybe Dortmund can go really deep in the Champions League again. Maybe they can push Bayern. It hasn't happened. And now, unfortunately, as you said, both those names are going to be out.
He had been out until November already this season, Reus. He's already missed lots of the season and his career's been injury plagued. Nice story, though, from Frankfurt. Marco Reus, captain at Eintracht Frankfurt, just to confuse things a little bit, Marco Reus.
How do you spell that?
R-U-S-S. So he made his first appearance for the club in quite a while in the Cup last week after making his return from testicular cancer. He was diagnosed at the back end of last season, even played in the relegation playoff against Nuremberg after his diagnosis, actually scored an own goal in that playoff tie, but has come back. He had chemotherapy. He didn't play at the weekend. He was on the bench for Frankfurt's league game against Freiburg. I think they lost 2-1. But a lovely story there with Marco Reus coming back. Okay, we're going to be reading out your highlights of the week after our interview with Phil Blacker.
For more, head to the website footballineurope.co.uk.
Okay, joining us now is Sky Sports commentator Phil Blacker. Phil, thanks for coming on the show.
Pleasure, Rob. Anytime.
Wanted to talk about the Chinese Super League because the season got underway at the weekend and you commentated on the debut of Carlos Tevez. Do you want to tell us, well, who he plays for and how he got on?
Yeah, a lot of expectations surrounding his debut for Shanghai Shenhua, becoming the world's highest paid player, of course. I mean, you could argue however he gets on, whether he's going to earn £610,000 a week is another argument entirely. Whether anyone is worth that is another argument entirely. But he certainly made a very, very positive start to his career in the Chinese Super League. He had played one game for Shanghai Shenhua before a disappointing defeat for them, actually, in the playoff round of the Asian Champions League. So they'd already suffered a big setback. One of their big aims for the season ended really before it had got started about a month ago. And then the build-up to the Chinese Super League, a difficult, certainly on paper, opening game for them. against Jiangsu Suning, the side that finished second last season, that beat Shanghai Shenhua in the semi-finals of the Chinese FA Cup last year. And Shanghai Shenhua won it by 4-0, and Tevez was pretty much everywhere. He scored a penalty on his debut. He set up two for Giovanni Moreno, the captain, involved it in winning the penalty as well. It was a typical all-action Tevez performance. Really. I mean, there's already been talk, even after he signed, within weeks of him signing from Boca Juniors, that he was unsettled. He hadn't taken to China, wanted to go home. I mean, you can understand maybe where those stories were coming from, but I think they're probably easy stories to level at and denied by his agent. And certainly if his performance on his debut in the Super League is anything to go by, then he's more than happy at the moment.
I was on TalkSport the other day talking about how Barcelona may make Lionel Messi the best paid player in the history of the sport, and I was rightly challenged on the amount of money Carlos Tevez is earning. Can you sort of outline the nature of his deal for a player who, you know, is not necessarily coming to the end of his career, but has peaked previously?
Absolutely astonishing figures. When he went back to his first club, Boca Juniors, you know, the assumption was, and I think he'd said it himself, he was going home to finish his career. He wanted to end it where it began, back home. It had always been his aim, I think, when he was playing in the Premier League. So to turn his head, to change his mind, the figures were going to be astonishing. But I think currently, Messi, Ronaldo, what are they, about 360-odd thousand pounds a week, ballpark figure. Tevez, this is what it was reported anyway, £615,000 a week. So that's £32 million a year, £88,000 a day. He's on a two-year contract. It's about £1 a second, I think. It's absolutely astonishing.
But there hasn't there been almost a cultural resistance? Because obviously there's been this idea in Chinese politics to expand football. It's seen as a good connector to the wider world as well. And they want a good national team. Hasn't there been a bit of political resistance to the amount of money and wages for the likes of Oscar, Witsel and Tevez who've moved in the winter transfer window?
That is just starting to sort of filter through now. Yeah, you're right. Obviously, a few years ago, the sums being spent in the Chinese Super League were nothing like that. All sorts of records broken again. The transfer window only closed last Tuesday, just before the start of the domestic season. And I think the figures were something like £331 million on transfer fees alone, before you take wages into account, were spent in that window, which is £38 million up on the previous window, which was also a record. But you go back, say, to 2013, and they'd spent only £25 million. Now, a lot of the reason for the spending was to curry favour with the president, who is a big football fan, who, as you alluded to, wants a strong Chinese domestic league, but also, maybe more importantly, a strong Chinese national team. And initially, the thinking was that the best way of going about that is to make the league the most competitive it can be, to attract the biggest players, the biggest names, and the Chinese talent, the domestic talent, will, you know, hand in hand from that, learn from playing with them, from training with them. And that's kind of been the attitude for the last couple of seasons. And now all this money has been spent on the likes of Tevez, on Oscar as well. He broke the transfer record for the actual fee that Shanghai SIPG paid to Chelsea. And I think a lot of people, maybe a little bit higher up in these government positions, have thought about this and said, well, hang on, you're burning money, I think, was the quote, in terms of what the clubs have been doing. And you look at the figures, and of all those fees and wages that I've been talking about, I think over 80% of them have been spent by the 16 top-flight teams on overseas players and coaches. And they're now thinking, well, actually, is this going to necessarily benefit the national team after all? Is this not just going to block the path of the younger players? So there's a couple of things that they've done. One is already enforced, and that is that they've reduced the number of overseas players that can be fielded at any one time. It was four last season. One of those had to be from another Asian country. Now it is three, full stop. You can't play more than three overseas players. You have to play one domestic-based under-23 player in the starting 11. You have to have another one on the bench as well. So those restrictions are already in place, albeit they only came in place, I think, after the transfer window had opened. So a lot of clubs had started doing their business, started spending this money and bringing the foreign players in, and now they've got them in their squads and aren't able to field them. Or some have already had to go out on loan. And then the other thing which the government are insisting will happen is that there will be some sort of wage restriction or transfer fee restriction from here going forward. I think that probably each individual deal is going to have to be ratified, and they will have to prove why it is beneficial, not just to the club, but to the league and the sport as well. So how that exactly is going to be enforced still isn't entirely clear at this stage, but it's definitely been, as you say, a shift in thinking.
I'm just looking at the goal scorers from the weekend, and more than double of them are foreign players, despite the fact that there are very few actually playing in the games. I mean, this weekend, Alex Teixeira, actually, who was linked with Liverpool from Shakhtar, was sent off for Jiangsu Suning against Shanghai Shenhua. So Tevez scored, Paulinho scored, just some of the names people would know. Hulk scored, Papi Cisse scored, Nikita Jelovic scored as well. There's no escape. I mean, it's the best players in the league are the foreign players at the moment. Do you think they care about international viewers for the league? Do you think that's a... Do you think they're that bothered by that? People watching in England or in other countries?
Again, I think that's part of the shift in thinking. That definitely, a couple of years ago, that was very much part of the appeal. They want to draw in a wider global audience, and that is why a lot of these players were brought in to do exactly that. And I think that there is a huge element of that that remains. You know, this is still a league which is growing year on year. The attendances inside the stadiums are going up every year, but also the viewing figures around the world because of those who are playing there are going up every year. And I think there's a general feeling that that remains a positive, but there's just concern at the amount of money that has been spent for that to happen without too much effect maybe on the national team. I know that's a long-term project, and that they actually did quite well to qualify for the final round of World Cup qualifying in Asia. They had to win the last couple of games to even get that far, and then depend on the results going their way, which they did. But since that stage, I think they've only got 2 points from their first five games. They're almost out of contention for qualification this time around. Marcello Lippi, of course, has come in and is now the national team coach, which fits with the profile maybe of the Super League. Of course, he had domestic experience previously with Guangzhou Evergrande, and he was actually lined up to go back there, replace Luis Felipe Scolari, before they thought, well, hang on, actually, the national team's more important, we want him, so Lippi went there instead. But to get back to your original question, I think there is a desire for this to be a worldwide product, because they think that will help the game in China. They're just trying to structure it a little bit more. It went all the way one way, and they're just trying to rein it in a little bit, I think.
Just looking at the spending, so vastly outspent the Premier League by something like £115 million in the winter transfer window. Also, I did see the Guangzhou Evergrande are looking almost in response to the not anti-foreigner sentiment in terms of signings, but looking to have an all-Chinese team by 2020. Truly bizarre. I mean, what do you make to someone like Axel Witsel going as well, Phil? I mean, this guy's at the peak of his powers. He could have gone to Juventus. He's obviously part of a Belgian national team that will be in contention to win the World Cup in Russia. Do you think it damages him as a player not playing in as competitive a league as he, maybe not necessarily in Russia, but maybe if he had gone to Italy?
I think there's a huge danger of that, and he's taking a gamble. The standard is improving all the time because of some of those players that we've talked about that scored at the weekend. Again, that I watched Shanghai Shenhua against Jiangsu Suning with a very decent level. And Tevez, yes, looked not necessarily head and shoulders above everybody, but you could certainly see the impact that he had on the team, how he improved it. I think there is the case to be made for a lot of clubs with the star overseas players coming in, and Axel Witsel has every chance of being one of those. But yeah, it is a danger that it's not going to be quite as competitive as he's used to. And there is the question whether the national team managers will consider the standard high enough. Yeah. You know, since you mentioned Alex Teixeira earlier, he's not really had a look in at international level with Brazil. He had a shocker, to be fair, against Shanghai Shenhua yesterday, and his frustration got the better of him, which is why he was sent off at the end. But it's not necessarily a place that the national coaches will look and say, well, they're playing in China, that's a level that's high enough for me to consider. That has to be a question. It has to be a gamble. Ultimately, money talks. Oscar, of course, has made the same move in a similar sort of situation. It may well be that they see this as a short fix because they're still in the peak years of their career. Maybe just go for a couple of years, make their money, then they never need to work again. I mean, it's all relative, isn't it? We're talking about players who are on fortunes anyway where they're playing. But these figures are another level. They may see that they could sample it for a year or so. If it doesn't work out, if the gamble doesn't pay off, they're young enough to come back and still play at the top level in Europe.
Yeah, if someone could buy them out of the contract as well, which is part of the issue, they're being paid so much.
Yeah.
Phil,
if they can afford to,
exactly. Can I just ask you a couple on the Eredivisie? I know you weren't working on it at the weekend, but you cover lots of the Eredivisie on Sky Sports. Feyenoord dropped points, losing the Rotterdam derby to Sparta Rotterdam. Matthias Pogba, one of the Pogba brothers, with the winner. Ajax dropped points, a 1-1 draw at Groningen. Davy Klaassen with a late equaliser to save them there. And PSV beat Roda 4-0. Bizarrely, Hector Moreno, the defender, scoring a couple of goals. What have you made to the Dutch title race this year, Phil?
It had looked as if, you know, it was fairly predictable at the moment in terms of the top teams winning every week. Until this weekend, that Sparta Rotterdam result, I mean, I haven't seen the highlights yet. I've got to gem up on that because I'm covering final next weekend, actually. That was an absolute shocker. I really couldn't envisage them dropping points at all, having come through the challenge against PSV the week before, which, you know, looked like it had probably ended PSV's challenge and their chances of retaining the title because they're already that little bit behind anyway. And then maybe the damage not quite as great for Feyenoord because Ajax failed to win, as you say, at Groningen before their Europa League tie coming up this coming week. So it really has thrown it back into the mix a little bit. I would still imagine that the Feyenoord should be in a position where they can see it through, but there is that big question mark because they haven't been down this road for an awful long time. And the closer that they get to ending their long wait for the title, the harder it is going to be. And maybe we saw the evidence of that against Sparta Rotterdam. Difficult sort of game for them anyway because of the whole the derby atmosphere and what it means. But a huge game against AZ Alkmaar next weekend that they have to bounce back in. You know, they're having a decent season in that little echelon of teams just below the title challenges as well. If Feyenoord can pick themselves up, prove that this defeat was just a one-off, just a little slip, and get themselves back to winning ways straight away, I think they'll go on to win it, but you do wonder if the extra experience in recent seasons of Ajax and PSV will come into play down that home stretch here. It just keeps the title race alive a little bit, and it's bubbling under nicely now. I think actually these results over the weekend, for a neutral perspective, have done the Eredivisie the world of good. It has thrown it back in the balance a little bit.
Final one from me, Phil. Just a quick one on the Champions League. You're commentating on Barcelona, Paris Saint-Germain alongside me for UEFA.com show Match Day Live. Do you give Barcelona any hope of turning that round, or is that 4-0 aggregate scoreline just too much?
I think it probably is too much. The only hope that I can see them having is a very, very slim one. I mean, you would never write off Barcelona entirely. This is a team that have proven over recent seasons what they're capable of, and they could still have, Messi could still have one of those nights. But I think particularly the failure to score the away goal in Paris as well as the four were conceded has probably done for them, hasn't it? Particularly the threat that Paris will carry going forward that we saw in the first leg. When I was given the second leg of this game, I thought, well, that's almost certainly to be in the balance going into the second leg. It should be an absolute cracker. But now it's a long shot in the extreme for Barcelona, isn't it? Typical.
Typical. Phil, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Not a problem, Rob. Enjoyed it.
Follow the Football in Europe account on Audioboom for the latest podcasts, interviews and special features.
And a big thanks to Phil, as always, for coming on the podcast. Chris Parrott is with me. Chris, shall I read out some of these highlights of the week from listeners?
Yes, please.
Scott Taylor. Feyenoord losing to Sparta, as we heard from Phil there, 1-0. Olympiacos losing consecutive games. Russia's top four all draw. And Basel held at bottom side Vaduz. Scott Taylor really getting across all the leagues there, isn't he?
In fairness, though,
that's
Basel,
better than us.
Basel not... He should create a podcast. Basel not beating Vaduz, yeah, that is... And also, as he said, when was the last Olympiacos? He didn't win a game, let alone two on the bounce.
Yeah, absolutely. Mr. Walker-Porter enjoyed the Las Palmas and Osasuna game, and then he's put seven football emojis, I think, for the seven. What was it? 5-2 in the end.
Yeah.
That game, 5-2 in the end. The Week in Football tweets us big wins at the bottom for Leganes and Depor in relegation 6-pointers. Pepe Mel involved in that. Chris Parrott has tweeted us. Oh, this is you about the own goal. I'll retweet that now.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm literally just scanning through.
That's what happens when, this is called preparation.
Tommy Cheatham. Tommy C, as he's known.
TC.
Monaco. They were such a joy to watch. Shame no one was there to do so in person. Okay, we'll talk about Monaco in a minute. Richard Connolly, friend of the show, said Feyenoord in was it over the line controversy for the second week running.
Yeah.
Where was Hawko when they needed it? Lost the derby 1-0. Of course, the goalkeeper taking the ball over the line the previous week.
By the way, Richard Connolly, his commentary was marvellous on the final PSV. Because, I mean, that was impossible to know what was going on, given it was, given we're talking not even, what's less than a millimetre? Is that possible?
I don't know, an atom?
An ant.
It was an ant's width. An ant's width. Richard Kaufman, another commentator and friend of ours, says he felt the goal looked in for him, the Matthias Pogba goal. Crazy to have Hawkeye for one match and not another in the same league.
I'll
tell you what,
true.
The two Richards are arguing it out. We've got to leave them there. And I think it was La Liga Gav says Barcelona being top back where they belong. I think they will win the league.
Who, Barcelona?
Yeah.
Do you?
Yeah, because they're going out the Champions League.
Ooh, that is, well, actually, God, we should have done it right.
Oh, yeah, let's not.
No, no, hang on, because the Clásico is, I think it's April 23rd. I mean, Sevilla aren't out of the title race, but that is enormous. I mean, of course it's enormous, but that is a potential title decider.
Okay. We'll do. Maybe we should watch that one together or something. That'd be
good.
That'd be nice, wouldn't it?
I'll put it in my file of facts.
France, Chris.
France.
The top three or one, and they will be the top three teams, surely, in France this year.
Yeah, and therefore Champions League football for PSG and for Monaco, no surprise, but for Nice too, which, okay, they've fallen out of the title race, I think, but what a season for them. And to they'll have to qualify, which, given their form in the Europa League this season, might be hard.
Yeah,
but
true.
Still, huge opportunity for that club in their new stadium.
1-0 win at Dijon at the weekend. Willian Cyprien with his 8th goal of the season. It's
absolutely
been excellent.
Monaco continue to lead the way. They hammered Nantes. Kylian Mbappe with 2. Valère Germain scored as well. I cannot wait for that second.
Bernardo Silva. I saw a lot of that game last night. Bernardo Silva was unbelievable.
Well, he is. And I'm so pleased because, as I've said before, 2 years ago, he was the best player at the European Under-21 Championship by a mile. They didn't win it. They lost some penalties in the final, Portugal. But when you see a talent like that, you just think, I really hope they continue to develop. And
they can't keep him, though, can they?
I'd be surprised. But it will take a lot. They signed him for quite a lot of money. And it will take a substantial bid, to say the least, to draw him away. But, I mean, I'd love to see him come to the Premier League.
Okay, so
I'm sure two Manchester clubs will be interested.
I'm sure City will be, definitely. I think Cavani got the winner, a penalty against Nancy on Saturday. PSG rested a load of players for that one. 37 goals in 36 games for Cavani as well, the real deal. But Chris, you picked out something about Portuguese coaches.
Yeah, so
Jardim, of course, is the head coach at Monaco and doing a fine job.
Yeah, and Sergio Conceição is the head coach at Nantes and doing a fine job too.
Said he turned down an approach
from
Leicester.
He did, and no reason to suggest that he's not telling the truth. Yeah, I mean, I love watching Conceição, which is an absolute nightmare to type, by the way. It's one of those names where...
Oh, where there's E's and A's and...
I definitely got it wrong, but you know, he was part of...
Conceição.
Sergio Conceição, mate. He's quality. But yeah, so France Football did a list of the most in vogue Portuguese coaches. Now, given that Portugal is a country of 10.5 million, it is extraordinary that they have...
So we've got Marco Silva in there, have we?
So actually, no. So this is the 10 they came...
Oh, wow, okay.
This is the 10 they came up with. Number one, Jose. Number two, Jorge Jesus. Number three, Jardim. Number four, AVB. Number
are
five,
these ranked?
Yeah, these were ranked. Yeah, exactly. Number five, Rui Vitória. Number six, Sergio Conceição. Number seven, Paulo Bento. Number eight, Paulo Sousa. Number nine, Nuno. And number 10, Paulo Fonseca. I mean, they're missing Carlos Carvajal from Sheffield Wednesday immediately. But what would you think about that list?
Jorge Jesus second?
Yeah, I thought that. Maybe a year, 2 years ago.
Yeah.
I don't think now.
Who's missing? I mean, in vogue.
Yeah, well, it's a difficult... Yeah, I mean, it's a difficult...
I mean, Marco Silva's pretty... in vogue, isn't he?
You would have thought so, yeah. But he hasn't made it onto the list. I mean, AVB, I wonder now. Now he's gone to China.
See
you later, AVB. I mean, hopefully you come back to Europe, and I'm sure he will, because he is still very young, Andre Villas-Boas.
Yeah.
I don't think he's 40 yet.
No, I don't think I don't think he is.
I don't think he is, which is incredible.
It's funny that when he was at Zenit, he was saying, I miss my family all back in Portugal.
I'm taking a year
sabbatical. And then he moves to China.
He also did an interview at the end of his Zenit reign where he was asked where he'd most like to go. And he said somewhere in the Russian Arctic. Because he apparently, there's Northern Lights and it's minus 60 and I'm sure it's glorious. But when I was reading that answer, I was like, your wife, you must have got home if she, and your wife said,
imagine
really?
Him saying stuff like that to John Terry in the Chelsea dressing room. Just thinking, oh, we've got to get this guy out.
Yeah, we want to go Marbs, mate.
By the way, I noticed the other day, the last English club to sack a manager after losing a round of 16 first leg in the Champions League went on to win it.
Yes.
AVB and Di Matteo. And Leicester have literally just done this.
And that was the last time Napoli were in the only time Napoli were in the round of 16 for the Champions League.
Very
thus
true.
Far, they won the first leg 3-1. This time they've lost the first leg 3-1.
Oh, Chris, we're all over it, boy.
Will they oust the mighty Madrid?
No. Do you want to go to Italy?
Yes, well, this would have been a seamless link into now Serie A. Speaking of Napoli, they had they had a brilliant win at the weekend. Dries Mertens is on fire.
Two goals for him in a 2-1 win at Roma. Pepe Reina in the third minute of added time has made what I saw Paolo Bandini in The Guardian call the save of the season. An incredible stop to get the points for Napoli. And it was a great result for Juve, despite the fact that they drew with Udinese, because Roma were second. And really, they needed to win that to keep touch with Juve. That probably ends their already slim title hopes.
And ends Roma's phenomenal home record. They'd won every single home league game this season.
Really?
Yeah, and I went further back. It's their first home loss since the 29th of November 2015.
That place was half empty at the weekend, by the way.
I know, which is given to...
It's unreal.
It is
unreal. Well, it looks so weird.
The whole thing about the new stadium and all of that business. It is such a shame because it is a great footballing stadium when it's full.
Yeah, the ultras are still boycotting it because of the perspex they have to stand behind in the south stand. Yeah.
But, I mean, bad few days after the first Coppa Italia defeat to Lazio as well for Roma.
Yeah, and I'm worth checking out, by the way... Dries Mertens' Finidi George tribute dog peeing celebration on the corner flag that he did for the first goal.
Did he?
He did. Have a look at that.
Quickly on Dries Mertens. I wonder whether he's the surprise. Obviously, he's a Belgium international. He's playing for a big club. But in terms of like players, if you were going to pick your dream 11, which we will at the end of the season, I think Dries Mertens would probably be in mine.
Oh, I like cross-European.
So is he the surprise package of the season?
I was saying the other day on TalkSport that I think he's been miscast. He might have been a striker.
All along. Mm.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean...
I don't know. He'd had a run of four games without a goal, but he's now on 22 goals for the season.
Yeah, he scored 18 in 24 league games. Right, last season, he got 5 Serie A goals, and the season before he got 6. I mean, that is... And we're only in early March.
Yeah, he could end up with 30.
Yeah.
Replacing the goals of Higuain and Bazzoli. I don't think anyone expected him to be the guy to do it. Chris, should we talk about AC Milan? I've been doing some digging on Milan.
Digging on Milan. So, what's happening? Is Silvio Berlusconi still in charge?
Yeah, he's still the president.
Right.
So... to break it down for people who don't know about the Milan takeover, there's obviously big money coming into Serie A. Chinese owners now, the Suning Group at Inter. There's a consortium called Sino-Europe Sports that agreed to buy the Rossoneri. The deal was expected to go through back in December, but the date of completion has been put back on more than one occasion. Now, they have had to pay two deposits to the Berlusconi family of 100 million euros each. So currently... technically, Silvio Berlusconi's brothers Paolo has 200 million euros in his pocket.
Well, how much are they buying the club for?
I don't know the full...
not that much,
the
more
full
than
fee.
That, surely.
Well, Donnarumma's worth 50.
Well, but if you did that, then buying a club would be expensive.
So that's happened. So on three occasions now, the group have been unable to pay on the agreed date, the latest being last Friday, March the 3rd. Berlusconi says, and there were reports that he was ready to pull the plug on the deal, but he says he's not worried. He's convinced the deal will go through. He's expected to still have a role on the board at AC Milan when the takeover goes through, of course. But we're in a situation whereby the Berlusconis, who've been in charge of Milan for more than 30 years now, may have 200 million euros in their pocket and not have to give up the club. There are concerns this consortium has run out, doesn't have the money. They say they do. They say they have more than enough money. It's weird, isn't it?
It's really odd. And all whilst they have a very good coach in Vincenzo Montella. And that's such a shame, isn't it? I mean, you know.
I was watching their game against Kiev. Steve Wyeth was commentating on it. Bacca scored two, but the front line for Milan was Suso, De La Feu and Bacca. It was half, the San Siro was half empty.
Yeah.
Like that club, I'm not saying this consortium are the people to save the club by any means. And the things Berlusconi's done for that club since he took over in the 80s has been extraordinary, turning them into a major European force, particularly in the late 80s. But,
yeah, it's sad.
Wouldn't it be peak Berlusconi for him to come away with hundreds of millions of euros and still be president with that? Oh, unbelievable.
We're in the wrong business.
Oh, we absolutely are. Okay, Chris, what else do we want to talk about? Russian league's back.
Yeah, Russian league is back. Very quickly on Italy, in terms of cup competitions in Europe, this must be the best this season. Semi-finals, Napoli, Juve, Lazio, Roma. Yes, please.
It's pretty strong, isn't it?
It's pretty strong, isn't it? But yeah, so Russia back after the winter months, near 4 month break, and I was going to say roared back. You did the game, wasn't quite, but one of the biggest games in Russian football to kick things off.
Yeah, CSKA Moscow against Zenit. They call it El Klassikov, which is one of their favourite.
Not quite as big as Spartak Zenit or CSKA Zenit. Or CSKA Spartak.
No, I would say it's the most important game in Russian football currently, but it's definitely not the biggest derby.
Yeah,
these are the two teams that have won every title this decade.
Yeah.
And they're behind Spartak, who lead the table. They drew 2-2 with Krasnodar at the weekend. And it was, Chris, it was an awful game.
Is it?
0-0.
It's a bit of a... I know it's great for the marketing men to be like, Russian Premier League's back, we've got this huge game. But sometimes you think it just comes a bit too early if it was 2 weeks' time.
Well, funny, that's what looked like the issue. Everyone looked rusty. Mm. It was the first game in charge for Viktor Goncharenko after he replaced Lenin Slutsky at CSKA. And Branislav Ivanovic was on the bench, didn't get used by Zenit.
Yeah, this is interesting because he made his debut in Europe, didn't he?
And they got beat at Anderlecht.
And he was pretty poor.
And he hasn't started a game since.
It's definitely an issue for Europe. Because they changed the Russian season from a summer season to align, and they were hoping that would improve European performances. It hasn't. In fact, the only Russian successes, Zenit and CSKA in the UEFA Cup, were when it was the Summer League.
Yeah, 06, 08, Zenit was 08, CSKA, 07 as well. Did they do it back-to-back?
No, they
won it once.
Yeah, I don't think they did it. It wasn't Russian clubs back-to-back, I don't think. But, Zenit were fantastic in the group stage this season. You thought, with Giuliano, he's been absolutely phenomenal.
Call out to the latest Brazil squad, by the way.
Exactly. And then Anderlecht scored in the last minute to knock them out in a brilliant...
Apparently that really killed them. I mean, Michail Lucescu, the head coach, said he couldn't sleep after that game.
Because, I just feel that I don't know how they can do it because, the temperatures don't permit football for that stretch. But somehow if Zenit and those clubs could have a better run-up to win the round of 32 or the Champions League kicks off, because I think they were real contenders to win that competition. But maybe that game came at just an inopportune moment for them.
Spartak still top, comfortably top, looking for their first title since 2001. Okay, Chris, I think we're basically done, but you do have a Reuben.
I do, and...
Because we have Champions League Europa League back again this week.
We do, 2 weeks in a row. Some brilliant games. So, tomorrow, Tuesday, marks 10 years to the day since Roy Mackay made UEFA Champions League history. That goal after 10.12 seconds. Still the quickest Champions League goal. So, first of all, I thought, I'll look for the quickest ever goal in football. It's an absolute minefield. 2 minutes on Wikipedia. Because it's like some...
Sorry,
some Romanian...
2 minutes on Wikipedia was all you put into it.
No. This part of it, I thought, because I'll find the quickest goal. That would be interesting, won't it? But it's like some under-12s game, and then there's one in like the Romanian second tier, allegedly in like 2 seconds.
Don't those Guinness guys have this locked down?
I think there's too many games and too many people saying, oh, I once saw a goal going in 4 seconds. It's like,
yeah.
Did you? So I thought I'd do fastest ever international goal.
Okay, give me it.
Shall I give you a clue?
Mm.
Here we go. He used to play for Arsenal and he moved to a club in Japan this week.
So Podolski?
Yep.
Because he's gone to Vissel Kobe?
Yep.
No idea. Germany against who?
Ecuador in 2013. He scored it in 6 seconds.
Do you remember that?
Nope.
Me neither.
There we go.
Incredible. Good stat, Chris.
Lukas Podolski.
Fastest ever international goal. 6 seconds, 2013. Germany, Ecuador.
Bang.
Off he goes to Japan with that record in his pocket.
Isn't it interesting now? Japan used to be, I mean, it is has a long history of football.
Mm.
And it used to be one of the places that people would go, like at Podolski's age, whereas now they go to MLS or China or the Middle East. Quite refreshing in a way that Podolski's gone to. You wonder if you're in Japan. You know, we look here at the Premier League and European leagues losing. We consider it losing talent to China. If you're Japanese, you've suddenly gone from a league which is, you know, very enticing for guys to being, you know, fourth or fifth option.
Wow. Let's see how Lukas Podolski gets on there.
Yeah.
I thought he was going to go back to Cologne. Apparently he flies back to Cologne every week when he was in Istanbul.
I mean, it's very nice, Cologne, but he loves it, doesn't he?
I know. Too much.
Too much.
Okay. We're back next week at FIE Podcast. If you want to get in touch, leave us a review on iTunes. Chris, see you next Monday.
See you next Monday. This is Football in Europe.